Pull up a chair. I want to tell you about the fastest funeral in the history of flight. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Taildragger, and you're listening to The Hangar, the place where we keep the old stories warm. And today we're going to talk about a machine that was retiring, and the two men who decided that if she had to go to a museum, by God, she was going to get there faster than anything had ever crossed this country before or since. March 6th, 1990. Remember that date? We'll come back to it. Before we roll, let me tell you today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story, and that's the whole point, isn't it? Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, let me set the scene for you. If you've never stood next to an SR-71 Blackbird, I don't know that I can do it justice. She's long, better than 100 feet of her, and she's black, but not a shiny black. A deep, dead, radar-eating black that seems to pull the light right out of the air around her. The skin is titanium. Most of it came from ore the Lockheed folks quietly bought through shell companies out of the Soviet Union, because the Soviets had the best titanium in the world, and the airplane built to spy on them was built out of their own dirt. There's a joke in there somewhere, and it's a good one. She was designed by a team under a man named Clarence Johnson. Everybody called him Kelly. Kelly Johnson ran the Lockheed Skunk Works out in Burbank, California. And if you want to talk about the greatest aircraft designer who ever lived, you can start the argument with his name, and you won't be wrong. Kelly's people started drawing this airplane in the late 1950s. Think about that. Slide rules. Pencils. No computers worth the name. And they drew an airplane that would fly at 3 times the speed of sound, 16 miles up, and stay there. 3 times the speed of sound. Mach 3 plus. Nobody ever put a real number on the top end, because the real answer was always the same. She could go as fast as she needed to. Here's the thing they don't tell you in the picture books. The Blackbird leaked, sat there on the ramp dripping fuel onto the concrete like a sieve, and that was on purpose. The metal skin was built loose with gaps, because when she got up to speed, the friction of the air would heat that titanium until it glowed, and the whole airframe would expand and swell and seal itself tight. She only became whole when she was flying fast. On the ground, she was a puddle. In the sky, she was the fastest thing men had ever built. Now here's where it gets interesting. By 1990, the Blackbird's time was running out. Satellites were doing a lot of the looking now. The airplane cost a king's ransom to operate. Every flight needed tankers standing by, needed a special jet fuel that wouldn't boil off at altitude, needed a whole traveling circus of specialists. The bean counters had her number. The Air Force was shutting the program down, and Lockheed and the Air Force agreed to give one of these airplanes, tail number 617972, to the Smithsonian Institution. She was going to the National Air and Space Museum. She was going to become a static display, a thing behind a rope that kids press their noses against. But somebody had a better idea. If you've got to fly her one last time, to deliver her from California to Washington, D.C., why not do it for the record? Why let the last flight be a sad little ferry hop? Let her run. Let the whole country watch her run one last time. So they made a plan. And the two men who drew the short straw, or maybe the long straw, depending on how you look at it, were Lieutenant Colonel Ed Yielding in the front seat and Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Vida in the back. Everybody called Joe Vida JT. He had more hours in the Blackbird than any man alive. If you were going to run this airplane across America against the clock on her very last flight, with the whole world watching, those were the two hands you wanted on her. Let me tell you what that back seat was. In the Blackbird, the front seater flies the airplane. The man in the back is the reconnaissance systems officer. He runs the cameras, the sensors, the navigation. On a spy run, he was the reason the whole airplane existed, and the navigation had to be perfect, because at that speed, you're covering a lot of ground in a very short time. You do the arithmetic, better than 2,000 miles an hour is better than half a mile every single second. Blink twice and you've crossed a county. March 6, 1990. They launched out of the Lockheed plant at Palmdale, California, out in the high desert north of Los Angeles. And to set an official record, you have to start the clock over a fixed point on the ground and stop it over another fixed point, with the timing measured by the folks who certify these things. The National Aeronautic Association was watching the clock. The plan was to enter the course out over the Pacific, coming in off the coast of California, and light the fires and go. Picture that cockpit, it's cramped. Ed Yielding is sealed inside a full pressure suit, a spacesuit really silver and bulky, because if anything let go at that altitude, your blood would boil in your veins in about the time it takes to say it. The visor's down, he's breathing bottled oxygen around him, the instruments glow, and ahead of him two Pratt and Whitney J-58 engines, each one a marvel that turns into something halfway between a jet and a ramjet as the speed builds. He pushes the throttles up into afterburner, and those two engines light with a sound that people who heard it never forgot. Not a scream, a tearing, a deep, ripping thunder that you feel in your chest cavity before your ears ever catch up. Shock diamonds standing in the exhaust like a row of glowing pearls, and she goes. The clock starts over the California coast. Now they climbed and they accelerated, and here's a detail I love. To go really fast, the Blackbird had to climb as she burned off fuel and got lighter, stepping up higher and higher into thinner and thinner air where there was less to push against. So the whole run is a slow, screaming climb toward the heavens. By the time she's across the middle of the country, she's up around 80,000 feet, 15, 16 miles straight up, high enough that Ed Yielding could look out over the nose and see the curve of the earth, see it bend away from him, blue going to black at the edges. One man later said that from up there you could see the sun and the moon and the stars, and the whole sweep of America laid out underneath you like a map on a table, and you were crossing the entire thing in about the time it takes to watch a sitcom. Let me give you the leg times, because they're just staggering, coast to coast. Los Angeles out on the Pacific to the Chesapeake Bay, they clocked her at 68 minutes and change, from one edge of this continent to the other. When you and I fly across the country, it's the better part of a day with the drive to the airport. She did the whole thing in a little over an hour. But the record everybody remembers is the coast-to-coast dash, and the official transcontinental mark they set that day was 67 minutes and 54 seconds at an average speed of better than 2,100 miles an hour. Average. That's not her top speed. That's the average across the whole run, the slow parts and the turns included. And along the way, they picked up more records like a man grabbing apples off a cart. St. Louis to Cincinnati, they ripped across in about 8.5 minutes. Kansas City to Washington, another mark, 4 separate world records, all in a single flight, all on the way to the Boneyard, all on the way to becoming a museum piece. Now think about the geometry of what JT Vida was doing in that back seat. You've got the whole country going by underneath at 0.5 mile a second. You've got to hit your timing gates. You've got to bring this airplane down out of the flight levels that no airliner will ever see. Slow her from 3 times the speed of sound, and set up an approach into Washington Dulles International Airport, into busy East Coast airspace, with the airline traffic and the general aviation traffic all going about their Tuesday. Slowing a Blackbird down is its own art. She did not want to slow down. She was built to go fast, and everything about her fought you when you asked her to quit. There's a famous story, not from this flight, but from the same airplane's life, about a Blackbird crew checking in with air traffic control and some other pilots getting on the radio, bragging about their ground speeds, and the Blackbird crew waiting, waiting, and then very quietly asking the controller to check their ground speed, and the number that came back was so far beyond anything else in the sky that the whole frequency just went silent. That was the airplane. That was the effect she had. When she showed up, everybody else was standing still, so they came down out of the blue-black edge of space, and they slowed her, and they set her up, and Ed Yielding brought that long black machine down final into Dulles, and she came over the fence and settled onto the runway, on those skinny landing gear, drag chute blossoming out behind her to slow her down, and she rolled out. And that was it. The last flight of an operational SR-71 Blackbird ended right there on the pavement at Dulles, on March 6, 1990. She'd crossed the entire United States of America faster than anyone ever had. And then she taxied in, and they shut down those two great engines for the last time, and the puddle started forming under her on the ramp, the way it always did when she cooled. There was a crowd waiting. There was a ceremony. And they handed the airplane over to the Smithsonian, right there, still warm, still ticking, as the titanium cooled and contracted, from coast to coast in 67 minutes, and then straight into history. Now, let me tell you where the story sits today. Because this is the part I love, that very airplane, tail number 617972, the one Yielding and Vida flew across America against the clock, is on display right now at the Smithsonian Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center out by Dulles in Virginia. You can go stand next to her, you can walk right up under that long black nose and look up at the same airplane that touched the edge of space on a March morning and set a record that has stood for more than 35 years and is going to keep standing, because nothing else operational has ever come close and nothing is trying to. And here's what gets me. Here's the thing I want you to carry out of the hangar today. That was a retirement flight. That was the day they took the keys away. And instead of going quietly, that airplane and those two men reached down and did the single most spectacular thing that machine had ever done on the very last day it would ever fly. They didn't go out with a whimper. They went out with a sonic boom that rolled across every state between the two oceans. There's a lesson in there about how to leave a thing you love. You give it everything you've got right up to the last second the clock is running. The details of that flight I've drawn from the accounts the crew themselves gave over the years, from Lockheed's own history of the Skunk Works and Kelly Johnson's team, and from the good folks at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, who keep her polished and tell her story to every kid who walks in the door. If you're ever near Dulles, go see her. Stand there a minute. She's earned it. You can find us anytime at RadioHangar.com. Back when Avgez was cheap and airspace was free, we used to think the sky had a ceiling. Two men in a spacesuit proved it doesn't, on the day they were supposed to be putting the airplane to bed. I'm Taildragger. Keep the shiny side up, and I'll see you next time.